Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide daily over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Once more, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, business, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on billions for the bankers, debts for the people, right after this. You know, when people call the law school and they ask how they can learn more about the topics that I speak on over the air, keep in mind that most of these topics that you hear on the radio I teach in detail in one of my schools here at the law school. For example, when you hear me talking about the common law, it was Alfred the Great who codified the common law in 872 A.D., and he put it into 49 principles or statutes called dooms, of which 22 of Alfred the Great's dooms or statutes have been incorporated into our federal constitution and our Bill of Rights. This common law was taken from the Mosaic Law, the law that God gave to Moses at Mount Sinai, and was recorded in Exodus 19, verse 16, through Exodus 24, verse 8. And it includes negligence, insurance, and taxes, you know, things like the income tax and property tax and social security taxes. Now, these IRS tax laws are a counterfeit of the tithing laws of the Bible, and they work a theft on everybody that participates in them. Now, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob gave us a better way of life than income tax and social security, and that's the basis of our tax and status quo. Now, we owe this income tax, all right, and I don't deny it, and the social security tax, because we've contracted into it. Well, has it ever occurred to us that maybe we might want to contract out of it? Now, if you'd like to learn more about tax and status, write for our free general law CD package. Remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website and send us an instead of sending us an email, why don't you go to our website and just click on to the archives page. That's an even better point. Just go to the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there off of our website. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, and go to the archives page. Hey, we're talking about billions for the bankers and debts for the people, and that's what we're observing today in the real world, where the banks are foreclosing on houses. They're foreclosing in our business community is not employing people, making things. Our industrial base has been offshored and outsourced to China. Now, a guy by the name of Ross Perot, you remember that name, Ross Perot? He was that funny little guy with his ears sticking out so far, you know? He's a billionaire, Texas billionaire. I think he's a patriot because he said back in 1992, he said, I'd like you people to elect me president of the United States. I think these politicians have been leading us down the primrose path, and I'm a self-made billionaire. And he was opposed to the World Trade Organization, the WTO and NAFTA. And he said, we don't want to get involved in that. That's bad policy for America. So you and I, being smarter than Ross Perot, smarter than God, we elected a guy named Bill Clinton. And he signed us up for NAFTA and the WTO. And then we elected a guy named George Bush. And then we got a new guy now. His name is Barack Obama. And we're not even sure that this guy, Barack Obama, is a U.S. citizen. I'm kind of suspicious myself, just based upon all of the hiding of it. You know, if you ask me, you know, am I a citizen? You know, where's your birth certificate? Where were you born? I could tell you, and you probably could too. But I've never heard Barack Obama say, "Well, why don't you check with the good folks in Honolulu, Hawaii, where my birth certificate is located, or wherever it is?" You know. But anyway, leaving that aside, we're living in a lot of deception here, a lot of lies going on, and we're in an economic crisis. You know, to use the term crisis, you know. And so I thought, well, let me take out this little book here on billions for the bankers over here, and let's see if we can't learn a little something from it. It isn't something that's hidden away. I mean, it's right out here in the open. You and I went to public school, and we were taught and trained to do business with these thieves, and sure enough, they have stolen from us. So one of the things I tell my students, and this is just a good principle of law, just write it down. If you never do business with a thief, you will never be stolen from. See how simple that is? Now, you may be sitting there saying, yeah, but how do I tell the thief from the honest guy? That's true. There's a problem there. We can do that. But once we've identified a thief, if you keep doing business with that guy, then you're a fool. There's an old adage that says, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Now, I don't know how many times I've watched TV, and I see this coming down the pike all the time. People are complaining about the banks, and they say, look, this bank over here cheated me. Hell, they cheated me on my credit card. They doubled my interest rate, or they did this or that, or they snuck these charges in on me, you know? Well, when they snuck these charges in on you, did they steal from you? When they doubled your interest rate, wasn't that a theft? Now, did you go down to the bank and close your account and close your credit card out and tell them to kiss off? You know, I'm not going to do business with you anymore because you're thieves. I don't see people doing that with banks. Now, people get real excited, you know, about some guy stealing their car. Oh, they get mad. Some guy comes in and he breaks into your house or he steals this or that from you. People just get really ticked off. But when the insurance company steals from you or the bank steals from you or the government steals from you, people accept that. That's normal. That's good. That's fine. There's no problem there. So people aren't opposed to being stolen from. They're just opposed to certain people stealing from them. See, you'd get mad as hell if I stole your car. But when the highway patrolman does it, it's okay. I understand that. I was breaking the law. I wasn't doing this or that right. It's okay for the bank to steal my house. I didn't make my payments. Now, I showed you in the last program, the reason you didn't make your payments on your house, son, is because you couldn't. It's impossible. Well, it's impossible for everybody to make their payments on their house. And you just happened to be one of the guys that couldn't make the payments. The other guys that could made them. The guys that can't make them didn't. But the banker never lost a quarter. And I showed you in the last program, I said, hey, we could have paid for all the houses in America for the amount of money we borrowed and gave to the banks and paid off all the mortgages. I'm not telling you that would be fair or that's good. I'm just telling you it would have been a better program than the one you adopted. Because the one you adopted, you took $15 trillion and gave it to the banks, and they said, if you don't give us the money, we're not going to lend to you. So you went out and indebted yourselves and used your representatives, remember your senators and representatives, to turn this money over to the bank. And you did. And now they've got the money and the mortgage on your house. And I said, you know, if you had taken the same amount of money and then given it to the people and then let the people pay the mortgage to the bank, the banks would have been paid the $15 million, or billion, or trillion, trillion in this case, but your house would be free and clear. As it is, you gave them the money and your house isn't free and clear, so they're going to get the $15 trillion that they took from you, that you gave to them, to bail the banks out, and they're going to take another $15 trillion by foreclosing on your houses or taking the payments, one or the other. So the banks are going to end up with $30 trillion. They were only entitled to $15. Hell, they weren't entitled to any of it. They created the $15 trillion out of thin air and then lent it to you at interest, which was a violation of the law. It violated the law of God. It didn't violate the law of the United States or California. It violated the law of God, but then you people don't practice the law of God. You practice the law of California and the United States. So maybe you deserve to lose your house. But in any event, I just wanted to explain to you why it's happening. You know, we ought to understand, well, here's what the problem is. Now, here's some famous quotations on money. Now, listen to this. A guy by the name of Sir Josiah Stamp, he's an Englishman, the president of the Bank of England. He's a banker, the president of the Bank of England. He was talking to a group of people back in 1920 at the University of Texas. It was an informal talk to 150 University of Texas students in 1920. Here's what he said. He said, banking was conceived in iniquity and it was born in sin. Bankers own the world. Okay, now let's pause right there. This is 1920. Hell, this is before any of us were even born. And here comes a banker and he's talking to some students and he says, bankers own the world in 1920. Well, did you think they lost? Did you think that they somehow gave it away or sent it back or something in the last 30 or 40 years, you know, maybe during the Clinton administration? Hell, these guys have owned the world, you know, for the last 4,000 years. And that's because they've been doing this trick for the last 4,000 years. And it's a hell of a neat program. I don't deny it. It's genius. Absolute genius. Satan outdid himself when he came up with this usury program. Anyway, he goes on to say, you take it away. Take the world away. Take all the money away from them, but leave them the power to create money. And with the flick of a pen, they'll create enough money to buy it all back again. Now take this great power away from the bankers, and all great fortunes like mine will disappear. And they ought to disappear, because this would then be a better and a happier world to live in. But if you want to continue to be the slaves of bankers and pay the cost of your own slavery, then let them continue to create your money. Well, okay, the bankers create our money. And they have been since in this country since 1913. And before that, they were creating private money in their own banks. Now, we had a president back in 1836. He shut the National Bank down. This was the U.S. National Bank of the United States, created in 1796, I believe it was. Ran for 20 years to 1816. Their charter was renewed and ran for another 20 years. Now, this present charter started in 1913. It's a charter, perpetual charter. It doesn't run out. Congress could repeal the National Bank charter, the Federal Reserve charter, in the morning if they wanted to. But you see, the Congress won't do that. And that's because the Congress works in concert with the Federal Reserve Bank. See, the two of them are like, they're like partners. They're like pilot fish cleaning a shark's teeth. The shark does not eat the pilot fish. That's because the two of them they have a symbiotic relationship. So politicians and bankers have a symbiotic relationship. And this guy, Josiah Stamp, is just telling you like it is, and he told you this back in 1920. then it would be helpful if you knew and understood that. Now, a lot of times people will come into class and say, yeah, but there's nothing we can do about it. It is true, and I agree with that. There's nothing that you and I are going to do, like Ron Paul, to audit the Federal Reserve or to change the people of the United States or the Congress or the bankers. But here's the beauty of this. You don't have to change the nation. You just need to change yourself. You personally can practice the law of God. You can stop paying usury and interest anytime you want. You don't have to use Federal Reserve notes. Here in the United States, we have gold and silver coin. You might not have any. You might not know where to get it, and you might not know how to use it. But you could learn, you know, if you put your mind to it. And then this guy, Josiah Stamp, who said, you know, if you want to be the slave of the bankers, you can. That's a choice for you to make. And if you don't want to be a slave to the banker, then you don't need to. You don't have to. And that's a choice that you can make. And the choice is yours to make. My job in life is not to persuade you as to what you ought to do. I'm just here to inform you as to what the alternatives are. And then you can make your own choice. I'm not here trying to free all the slaves. Because, boys and girls, if we freed all of the slaves, who would do the work? I don't want to do the work. And I'm perfectly happy to have millions of American slaves who are out here working to pay taxes, support the banking and the economic and political system. But I don't want to do it. That's all I'm telling you. But I don't want to do it. Now, the bankers don't want to do it, and the politicians don't want to do it, and I don't want to do it. And so the work has to be done by somebody, so let the slaves do the work. And then you and I, maybe we could go out and do something a little more intelligent. Now, that was Josiah Stamp. Now, listen to some of our famous old-timey politicians. Listen to this. Thomas Jefferson, he was right on top of it. He said that, I believe that banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than standing armies. Already they've raised up a moneyed aristocracy that has set the government at defiance. The issuing power of money should be taken from the banks and restored to the people to whom it belongs. Now, he said that in 1816. Now, he wrote a letter to a guy named George Logan, and he said, I hope we shall crush in its birth this aristocracy of the moneyed corporations, which dare already to challenge our government to trial of strength and bid defiance to the laws of our country. He said that in a letter to George Logan in November of 1816. Now, Jefferson made this observation. He also said that if the American people ever allow private banks to control and issue their currency, first by inflation and then by deflation, the banks and the corporations will grow up around them, will deprive the people of all of their property until their children will wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered. That's where we're at today. I just don't want to be one of those that wakes up homeless. I'm not concerned about the people that do wake up homeless. So if you thought that I was out here trying to get you to vote for somebody or get you on the bandwagon or get you to send me your tithes and offerings there, brother, we're not interested in that at all. This is an educational program, and our objective here is to send out information. And so we pick it out. These are famous quotations on money by some very famous of our own politicians and world leaders. James A. Garfield said, whoever controls the volume of money in any country is absolute master of all industry and commerce. The banking industry in America is absolute master of General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, Boeing, the Congress. They're absolute master of the United States of America. John Adams wrote to Thomas Jefferson in 1787. He said, all the perplexities, all of the confusion and distress in America arise not from defects in our Constitution or Confederation, and not from any want of honor or virtue, so much as from the downright ignorance of the nature of coin, credit, and money. Well, the average Joe Sixpack American is just downright ignorant about coin, credit, and money because he starts out his educational career in the public school. Starting in kindergarten, he's taught and trained. Fiat money is good for you. Borrowing money and paying interest and usury is good for you. He goes to church, and the preacher tells him that debt is good for you. In fact, here's one for all of you religious guys out there. Here's God telling you in the Bible, and remember in Leviticus 25, 36, and 37, and Deuteronomy 23, 19, you shall not lend upon usury. Then your church wants to add a wing on, and so they go out to the bank and they borrow the money, and they get you people to sign the pledge card so that you're the surety underwriters of the church's debt, so that you can pay your tithes and offerings, so that you can pay these bankers their usury, which God told you not to do. See, you go to church and your preacher teaches you to break this law. Well, there are penalties, you know, that come from that. Now, typically, the church gets paid off, and, you know, everybody's happy. But you people would live about twice or maybe three times as good. Your standard of living would be two or three times higher if you weren't paying this money off to somebody else. In other words, if you would build one house for you, instead of buying one house for you and two for the banker, if you were to buy three houses and kept all three of them, wouldn't you be money ahead? Wouldn't you be wealthier? Now, the average American is buying one house for himself and two for the banker. Now, I've reported to you a guy named Henry Moore. He bought seven houses, and he bought them all for Henry. He's sitting there. He's living in one rent, and the other's out. He makes more money off of his own endeavors in his lifetime than you people are making off your Social Security in retirement. And you can do it, and I can do it, and so can anybody else. All right, so President Jackson, I read to you in the last program, he said, gentlemen, I've had men watching you for a long time, and I'm convinced that you have used the funds of the bank to speculate in the breadstuffs of the country. Banks like Goldman Sachs, they use this money to speculate. They buy stocks and bonds. They've got things called front running. I mean, they can actually, they're so powerful. Let me tell you a little story here. I had an old buddy by the name of John Granbush. He used to run an outfit called the National Commodity and Barter Association out in Denver, Colorado. Well, John's dead. He'd been dead for years and years now, but he was a pretty good old boy, and he was a hard money advocate, and he was a good patriot, a good conservative fellow. Well, anyway, while he was running this National Commodity and Barter Association, one day he puts out a buy order for 100 bags of silver. Now, this is back, you know, in the 80s. 100 bags of silver. So as this thing winds through the pipeline, nobody's got 100 bags of silver, so guys are calling everybody and saying, hey, John Granbush needs 100 bags of silver. Now, back in those days, a bag of silver back, I guess, in, 86, 7, 8, 9, long in there somewhere, was selling for around $4,000 or $5,000 a bag. So 100 bags of silver, we see how much that is. 100 times 5,000, let's say $5,000, would be $500,000. That's a chunk of money. It's $500,000. So John he puts out the buy order. Now listen, while silver is selling for $5,000 a bag, John's order, as it circulated through America over about 3 days, ran the price of silver up 6%. Just 100 bags, 6%. And when I heard that story, I said, oh my God. Now imagine what J.P. Morgan does. You see, J.P. Morgan, they've got billions and billions of dollars. And you heard about the Hunt brothers trying to corner silver back in the early 80s? Well, J.P. Morgan has done what the Hunt brothers can't do. They control the price of silver. Now, by doing that, they can hold the price of silver down or they can force the price up. And then a guy by the name of Warren Buffett, he did this one time. He went out and he bought, whether it was $1 billion or $2 billion worth of silver. And when he did, he drove the price of silver up $7 an ounce. Well, then when the price of silver went up $7 an ounce, he sold it all. And so now he makes the $7 an ounce. Say he bought 1 million ounces of silver for $10 an ounce. Price of silver goes up $7 an ounce. And so he sells it at $17, and then pretty soon you and I are sitting there holding the silver, and the price starts edging down and down and down and down. Pretty soon it ends up back at $10 again. And this manipulation of the markets like this by people that have all this money, and there's, it isn't just J.P. Morgan. There's all kinds of other hedge funds and others that are doing that. So that the little guys like you and me, what I call the bottom feeders, we take it in the shorts. That's the bottom line. These guys are constantly making money. They get us to go out and do the work and pay the taxes. They get us to join the army and go fight their wars for them to make the world safe for Standard Oil, so they can build pipelines across Afghanistan and we can steal 25% of the world's oil supply in Iraq. It doesn't benefit the Iraqis. It doesn't benefit you and I, but it benefits Standard Oil and ExxonMobil. The five big oil companies in the world, I don't know if you knew this or not, but Iraq has proven oil reserves that equal 25% of the world's reserves. 25%. So if you want to know what the war in Iraq was over, it wasn't over democracy or Saddam Hussein. It was over 25% of the oil in the world. And these five oil companies, now that we took over the government, threw Saddam Hussein out, we got our own puppet government in there, they went over there and made contracts. Now, we don't know what the specifics of the contracts are. That's a state secret. It's like this $15 trillion that the banks got. You can't get an audit on it. No, it's a state secret. Isn't that special? So the Congress, using our power of attorney, went out and borrowed $15 trillion, gave it to the banks, and now when we say, give us an audit, they say, oh, it's a state secret. And then this guy, Ron Paul, he put a bill in the Congress, and he said, hey, let's audit the Federal Reserve. You know where that went? Into File 13? You're not going to get an audit of the Fed. Come on, let's wake up and smell a coffee here. Now, we've had a number of politicians. Abraham Lincoln had something to say about money. He said, the money power preys upon the nation in times of peace and conspires against the nation in times of adversity. It's more despotic than monarchy, more insolent than autocracy, more selfish than bureaucracy. It denounces as public enemies all who question its methods or throw light upon its crimes. So here's Abraham Lincoln. He says, the banking industry over here, it is a criminal enterprise committing crimes. Now, of course, not everybody agrees with that. I'm sure that most people with a mortgage on their house and they're making their payments and they're happy as clams at high tide probably, you know, have good words about the banking industry and the Congress and one thing and another. But Henry Ford, he wasn't necessarily in politics, but he had a little something to say about it. Congressman Jerry Voorhees had something to say. Woodrow Wilson, the guy that got this whole thing started, see, Woodrow Wilson signed this Federal Reserve Act back in 1913. He said a great industrial nation is controlled by its system of credit. Our system of credit is concentrated. The growth of the nation, therefore, and all of our activities are in the hands of a few men. We have come to be one of the worst ruled, one of the most completely controlled and dominated governments in the civilized world. No longer a government of free opinion, no longer a government by conviction and the vote of the majority, but a government by the opinion and duress of a small group of dominant men. Now, this small group of dominant men are people like Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, Tim Geithner. I mean, you know, there's probably 100 men here in the United States that run our top banks, the top CEOs of the top multinational corporations that are Barack Obama's handlers and send messages to the White House and say, Mr. Obama, this is what we're going to do next. And then if you don't go along with us, you'll end up dead like John Kennedy, Abraham Lincoln, James A. Garfield, you know. And you get lippy with us and this is what we'll do to you. The President of the United States, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, you know, these great politicians, you know, that have all these meetings over here, these guys follow their instructions. The 13 most powerful men on planet Earth are the 13 owners or the 13 directors of the Bank for International Settlements, the BIS in Switzerland. Those are the guys that make the policy worldwide. And then the central banks carry those out. If you want to know who's got the real power, it's Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve Board. Now, they act like they're just real subservient, and they're coming into the Congress to testify, and, you know, just, and the congressmen, they just act real tough. Mr. Bernanke, are they asking questions, you know? That's a part of the cover story. That's a part of the ruse. Behind the scenes. And then the reason we know that behind the scenes is that if the Congress was, in fact, in control, then they would call for an audit of the Fed and say, what in the hell are you guys doing over there? Answer our questions. But when the congressmen are acting real tough on CNN, and then when a bill comes up and says, hey, we want to audit the Fed, they all vote against it. You will know, this is what Jesus said. He said, you will know them by their fruit. By their fruit. And let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and that we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on Compact Disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. That's for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. 67. Now, if you're online, go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click onto the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or the publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are talking about billions for the bankers, and we're discussing here today in this program some comments made by famous politicians, businessmen. Here's what Henry Ford had to say about the banking system. He said, the greatest thing in life is experience. Even our mistakes have value for us. Take the matter of money, for example. There is no doubt that financiers have failed to do their best to give us an efficient money system, and yet it was their principal business to do just that. The function of money is not to make money, but to move goods. Money is only one part of our transportation system. It moves goods from man to man. A dollar bill is like a postage stamp. It is no good unless it will move commodities between persons. If a postage stamp will not carry a letter or money will not move goods, it's just the same as an engine that will not run, and someone's going to have to get out and fix it. All right, boys and girls, the purpose for money is to move goods. For instance, you go to work, and your boss says, I'll pay you $10 an hour, and so you're a mechanic, and you go out and you fix people's cars. Your boss gives you the money, and you take it down to the grocery store, and you give the money to the grocer, and he gives you the carrots, the beans, and the peas. The grocery store guy gives that to the wholesaler who buys the corn, the beans, and the peas. And this money passes down to the farmer who in turn pays the hired man who in turn pays. This money, in its, you know, its final analysis, is for the purposes of moving goods. But when you've got this fiat currency running around out here and you can create it and manipulate it, you can actually use that to make money. You can use money to make money. And that's what usury is all about. I will give you $100 and you give me $106 back. Now, God, you know, he looked at that and he said, well, okay, if you give me $100, you got to have $106 in the game to give back $106. And the banker ain't putting in $106, he's just putting in $100. Then he takes your mortgage on your house for $106. And when you can't pay back the $106, then he takes your house. The worst thing that can happen to you is that you buy a house, 30-year mortgage. You've got 360 payments. You make 359 payments, but you can't make the 360th payment. And they take the collateral away from you because you're short one payment. They take your house over one payment. Best thing that can happen to you is that you make the deal, and then they take the house from you because you can't make the first payment. Now, when you buy a house on time at 6% interest, buy a $50,000 house, 6% interest for 30 years. The break-even point is 5 years, 60 months. And every dollar that you spend on that house in payments after the first 5 years is a loss. Most people, they don't understand that. They can't do the arithmetic. So let me put it to you this way. You got a house and you got it bought and paid for, and you were one of the good guys, and you borrowed the money, and then you paid your 360 payments. Well, you bought one house for you and two for the banker. Well, just figure it out. How much did you pay for the house? What were the payments you made? Multiplied by 360, and you got one $50,000 house. And it cost you $150 to buy it, so you bought one for you and two for the banker. And if that's a good deal and you like that deal, well, stick with it. It's not illegal, and I don't care. It's nothing to me. But it would seem like to me to be a better deal, instead of buying a $50,000 house, if you went out and bought the lot, bought the material, and built the house yourself and did it for $25,000. Or if you build it yourself, you could build a $50,000 house for $12,500. You could have it built for you for $25,000. That's what Russell Harvey did in 1940. He paid $3,000 to build a house, three-bedroom house, about, I don't know, 1,800 square feet. Paid $3,000 in 1940. He helped a carpenter build the house. But we don't do that anymore. We got to have turnkey houses now. We got to have a house out here in the tract. We got to have, you know, something built for us and so on. That's fine. If that's what you want to do, you got to be prepared to pay for it. That's all. Now listen to this. Thomas Edison said this: if our nation can issue a dollar loan, it's capable of issuing a dollar bill. The factor which makes the loan valid is the same which would make a dollar good. Both are promises to pay, but one enriches the usurers and the other would help the people. Democratic Congressman Jerry Voorhees said this. He says, the banks, the commercial banks and the Federal Reserve create all the money of this nation, and its people pay interest on every dollar of that newly created money, which means that private banks exercise unconstitutionally, immorally, and ridiculously, the power to tax the people. For every newly created dollar dilutes to some extent the value of every other dollar already in circulation. Money creation is the greatest economic power known to men, and that power ought always to be exercised in the interest of all of the people, never for the sake of private gain of a privileged few. Well, now that's exactly the same story that we got from Josiah Stump. Remember that? He said the same thing. And who was the other guy that said the same thing? This is the third guy now that said that. John Moody wrote this. He said, seven men on Wall Street now control a great share of the fundamental industry and resources of the United States. Three of the seven men, J.P. Morgan, James J. Hill, and George F. Baker, head of the First National Bank of New York, belong to the so-called Morgan Group. Four of them, John D. and William Rockefeller, James Stillman, head of the National City Bank, and Jacob H. Schiff, of the private banking firm of Kuhn Loeb Company to the so-called Standard Oil City Bank Group, the central machine of capital extends its control over the United States. The process is not only economically logical, it is now practically automatic. Hey, here's another little trick for you. Maybe you didn't know this. It's called the interlocking boards of directors. We get to looking at the board of directors of Chase Manhattan Bank, and we find that some of those guys will be sitting on other boards of directors like Boeing or Lockheed or Microsoft. And then when you look on the board of directors at Microsoft, you'll find that their board members there, they're sitting on the board of directors of J.P. Morgan or maybe Procter & Gamble or maybe General Motors. And then you look at the board of directors at General Motors and you find out that, God, these guys are sitting on the boards of directors of Dell Computers and Microsoft and somebody else. Those are called interlocking boards of directors. All right, now here's what the bottom line is. Those men sitting on these boards of directors of these various big multinational corporations are working for and take their orders and directions from these few men at the top. You know, the guys that are running the think tanks, you know, like Skull and Bones or Goldman Sachs. It's not the politicians now sitting in your Senate seats. Those are called insiders. They're in on the game, no doubt about it. But they're not the guys calling the shots. The President of the United States, he's in on the game. He's a player, but he's a minor player. He's a politician. He takes his instructions. He takes his instructions from the 13 members of the Bank for International Settlements. And then they, in turn, they send out their instructions down to the next level and the next level. And a guy by the name of John Coleman wrote a book called The Committee of 300. John Coleman, Carson City, Nevada. Look it up, and I'll do a Google search on that, and that'll tell you a lot about it. But as we're talking about this billions for the banker, now in the last program, I'm going to show you what the solution is for you and me. If we don't have a solution, we don't need to know what the problem is. But we've got a solution, and we got it from our Creator. And he said, now listen, I got a law over here. It's called the Ten Commandments, and I've got 17 economic laws. You practice these 17 economic laws, practice my Ten Commandments, and you can cut yourself loose from these bankers. And in the process, you can make a lot of money. This program here in the scripture, here's one of the benefits that you get. He says, everything that your hand touches will prosper. Everything that your hand touches. Now, I'm an old-timey general contractor, and for you contractors out there, you can remember you went out and you made a deal, right? You bid on a job. Did you make money on every deal that you made? No, you lost some money on some deals. Everything you put your hand to doesn't prosper. But under this program, everything you put your hand to do will prosper, guaranteed. It's one of your 33 articulable benefits. Now listen to this Mayor Amschel Rothschild. Mayor Rothschild, back in 1700, he said, quote, permit me to issue and control the money of any nation, and I care not who makes its laws. You got that? It isn't important who's making the laws over here in the Congress. It's the guy that's making the money, the guy that's creating the money. Now here in the United States, the people that create the money is called the Federal Reserve Board. These are the people that control the Congress. If you get out of line, they'll withhold your money. Now the way you get elected, you've heard the story that money is the mother's milk of politics. And the guy that's advertising, there's a woman out in California now. She's running for, she's the Republican candidate. She spent $119 million so far. Her name is Meg Whitman. $119 million so far of her own money, running on the Republican ticket in a Democratic blue state. You know, for $20 million, she could have given that to the Democratic Central Committee of California, and she could have bought the Democratic nomination and been elected for nothing. I don't know where that woman's mind is. But you know, people that have $1 billion or $2 or $5 billion, you know, those aren't dumb people. Now remember Ross Perot? He spent his own money running for president. It might be that these people are true patriots and they're just out there wanting to save America. But you know, I can tell you from personal experience in Idaho, you can buy a house seat for as little as $10,000 in 1980. It might cost you $25,000 today, you know, with inflation. But if you wanted to be elected to the House of Representatives in the state of Idaho, $25,000. Should do it like a shot. Now, if you want to be elected senator in California, there was a guy did that a few years back, spent $26 million and didn't quite make it. So it costs millions of dollars to be elected senator of New York or California, but $25,000 will put you in as a rep in the state house in Idaho. Probably $100,000 would put you in as a representative in Washington, D.C. And get this, the people that are putting up that money for those politicians are the business. It is the bankers. It's the business concerns of America. They elect those guys. And then when they get to Washington, there's a quid pro quo. Quid pro quo. Let me show you an example. I met a guy by the name of Dick Armey. He was a representative from Texas. Well, Dick Armey went out of office in 2004. He retired, but before he went out of office, he put a rider on a bill. And this rider said that if you're damaged, let's say you got your child, and you take your child in and have them vaccinated, and this vaccination causes your kid to get killed, guess what? You can't sue the pharmaceutical company that made the vaccine, even if the vaccine was at fault. There's a special fund, and I forgot the name of this fund, but there's a vaccine fund, and that's where you get compensation. You get compensation from the taxpayers. Now, what this boils down to is the same kind of a free ride that the banks get. It's a bailout. See, we have a thing here called product liability. It's written into our law. It's an Anglo-Saxon administration. I build a house. The house falls down. I got to make it good. I got to pay you. You're going to sue me because I built you a bad house. All right, that's called product liability. Well, if you make a vaccine and you go out here and sell it in the marketplace and it kills somebody, they're going to sue you for wrongful death, and you got to pay them. See how simple that is? No fuss, no muss. Now, let's suppose I don't want to have to pay you for my house, and so I go to the legislature and I say, hey, pass a law for the general contractors of California that says when we build your house, if it falls down, you got to be compensated out of the Fallen Down Houses of California Compensation Fund enacted by the legislature of California. I know it sounds stupid, but that's exactly what the Congress has done for vaccines. They've got a vaccine fund over here, and it has $300-$500 million on it. And if let's say Pfizer or Merck or somebody turns out a vaccine and it's bad, then you want to sue Merck or Pfizer? No, you can't. They're exempt. They got to get out of jail free card. So you can't sue Merck or Pfizer. You got to sue this fund, and then you'll get paid out of this fund if you can prove your case. And they get a free ride, and the taxpayers pay for all of it. Just like the banks get bailed out, and the taxpayers pay for all of it. Now, as long as these pharmaceutical companies and banks and insurance companies can get away with that, why shouldn't they? There was a deal just came out the other day where the mayor and the city council, chief of police and fire chief, they voted themselves, a little town called Bell, California, down Southern California around Los Angeles, and I forget now how much it was, but I think the mayor was getting $800,000 a year. Hell, the president of the United States only gets $400,000 a year. Here's the mayor of a little town of about, I don't know, 8, 10, 12,000 people getting $800,000 a year. Well, finally, the people woke up to what was going on, and they've been raising hell down there, and there's you know, just all kinds of flack coming down. The chief of police is getting $400,000 a year. He's getting paid. Here's the chief of police of a little town of 10,000 people getting paid as much as the president of the United States. How does that happen? Well, you people are all asleep. You're not paying attention to what the hell's going on around you. And as long as you got a job and, you know, a six-pack of beer and a bag of potato chips and some dip, you can sit there and watch TV on Friday night. Hell, you're happy. You don't care anything about the mayor and his compensation. Now, when you end up unemployed and they're taking your house away from you, then all of a sudden you start waking up and saying, hey, what's going on around me? I've been asleep here, and now I'm awake. What's been going on? So if you've awakened now and you're wondering what the hell's going on around you, well, this is what it is. The bankers are in control of America. The bankers are in control of France. The bankers are in control of Great Britain and Russia and Japan and every other country in the world, and they're working together to create this new world order, this utopian communist new world order for us. And if that's what you want, stick with the program. You've got to win it. Now, on the other hand, on the other side of the coin, you know, those little guys, the bottom feeders, are paying for all of this. And so as a result of that, some years back, I woke up one day and I said, you know, I don't think I want to pay for all of this. Listen to a couple more of these neat statements over here. A guy by the name of Robert Hemphill. For 8 years, he was the credit manager of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, Georgia. Once in a while, you know, one of the insiders says, hey, let me tell you what's going on here. Here's Robert Hemphill. He said, if all bank loans were paid, no one would have a bank deposit, and there would not be a dollar of currency in circulation. Now, this is a staggering thought. We are completely dependent on the commercial banks. Someone has to borrow every dollar that we have in circulation, cash or credit. If the banks create ample synthetic money, we're prosperous. If not, we starve. We are absolutely without a permanent monetary system. When one gets a complete grasp upon the picture, the tragic absurdity of our hopeless position is almost incredible. But there it is. Yet, the banking problem is the most important subject that intelligent persons can investigate and reflect upon. It is so important that our present civilization may collapse unless it's widely understood and the defects remedied very soon. Well, you can sit back and you can relax. The intelligent people and the dummies, like all the rest of us, we're not going to wake up and make any meaningful changes. And Ron Paul is not going to get an audit of the Federal Reserve, and I doubt seriously that 8,000 tons of gold in Fort Knox is still there. I think it's been looted by the bankers, and I think it's already been removed, which is why our Congress keeps voting against this audit. You know, if the money was there, nobody fears an audit if the money's there. The only time you fear an audit is when an audit is going to reveal shortages. You can rest assured that if the 8,000 tons of gold was sitting in Fort Knox, Ben Bernanke would have said, bring it on. Go ahead. Audit the Fed. Everything's there. We're not short a dime. the Fed is fighting right now in court to keep that audit from going forward. I think Ron Paul hit a raw nerve. Now remember this, the Federal Reserve is an eleemosynary trust. Eleemosynary is a religious trust, if you can believe this. The Federal Reserve is a religious trust. Eleemosynary trusts cannot be audited. It's against the law. So number one, they're protected there. So I suspect that when the Supreme Court rules on this, they're going to say you can't audit it. Why? It's an eleemosynary trust. It's exempt from audit. That's number one. Number two, the money isn't there. And that's why they're fighting it, because they don't want you people out there to find out that all the gold that we passed into the government in 1933 has been looted by the bankers. So we passed our gold in, and our government put it in Fort Knox and then put the bankers in control of it. Meanwhile, they've looted all the gold from Fort Knox. But on the books, it says it's there. It says it's there. Well, what the hell do you want them to do? Say, yeah, we took it all and it's now sitting in Zurich, Switzerland, and we looted it. Hell, you people might get upset about something like that. That's like finding out that the mayor of your little town of 5,000 is making $800,000 a year, double what the president of the United States is making. Hell, you people might wake up and get up off the couch if you heard something like that. And as long as you people are satisfied and happy with the status quo, the bankers can go on looting and robbing you. And remember this, they're not looting and robbing all of your money. They're just taking a little bit from a lot of people regularly. One day I woke up and I said, you know, I don't like this idea of the bankers looting a little bit from me regularly. I don't want to pay them a dime. I don't want to pay them anything. I had a guy one time, he was the administrative assistant to the sheriff of Ada County, in, Idaho. And he said to me one day, he said, you know, Gordon, what your problem is when the pie of life goes by and somebody sticks his thumb in and pulls out a plum, you get upset. And I said, you're damn right. It's because that's my plum. Keep a your hands off of my plum. Now, I'm out of time here again, boys and girls, so I got to give you a reminder here that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. That's for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.